I'm get you bringing the bard out this early on in the pod.
What's the word I'm looking for? It's the Easter weekend, so my brain is half working.
This previous ruler, whose name I've completely forgotten,
Dave.
but yeah,
Dave San.
they enrich the mind and nurture the spirit at the Willow World, much like we do on TV DNA.
It's more that cloud and rain talk.
Yeah.
Well, just putting it out there, I'm always open. My openness is open to a lot of people.
This podcast was recorded remotely and contains adult themes and language. Hello and welcome to TV DNA Shogun, episode 5, Broken to the Fist, and episode 6, Ladies of the Willow World. My name is Adam Hemming, and all men are like falcons, none less so than Damien Flown the Cooper.
Oh, that's very nice. Did the earth move for you too?
So we're now 60% of the way through this show. Four more episodes to go. How are you finding it? You still enjoying it?
Yeah, definitely. There's so much of this that I like. The pace is slow, and there was a little bit, I think it was episode 4, episode 5, it could be episode 6, a little bit of an unnecessary recap of the political situation that I found a little frustrating. But all in all, I think it's good. I think there are some fantastic performances. I'm still not convinced about Cosmo Jarvis, I'll be honest with you. But everyone else, I'm really enjoying.
Yeah, I agree. I think the plot is moving along and we are getting more background on certain characters and bits and pieces like that. I mean, it's an epic story, isn't it? So I think it's sort of taking the time that it needs to in a way. But yeah, excited for what's to come in the future episodes, definitely. Well, we start episode 5 with a bring out your dead scene. It was very reminiscent of the Monty Python. Because they're loading dismembered corpses onto a wagon, which I quite enjoyed. Obviously, after the canon scenes of episode 4, the end of episode 4. But as predicted, Buntaro lives.
Always. If you don't see him die, they haven't died. My question is this, though. Buntaro lives. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead here, but I might forget otherwise with my old brain. But when John was asking him to tell the story of how he managed to escape, he got very defensive and he tried to move the subject on. So I still am not 100% convinced. All we know is that a small team of Ronin, i.e. samurais without a master, were there and happened to help him. And just Bentaro and one other Ronin made it to safety, and that Ronin is no longer alive. So for me, I think that's a little bit suspicious, shall we say, that he managed to survive and no one else is alive to tell the story of how he survived.
Yeah, I picked up on all of that as well. I agree. I think it is highly suspicious. Do we think that he's maybe been turned then?
Yeah, I mean, it would also explain why he was, even by his standards, so absolutely horrendous to Mariko.
Yeah, I mean we get a lot of that, don't we? I mean, there's the events of episode 5 where basically there's a drinking contest or a slurping contest at one point between him and Blackthorn. There's a really cool moment where he fires an arrow past Mariko's face, and then a not cool moment where he beats her up essentially. And he's accused of dishonoring his host. He's made to live with Blackthorn in his residence because that's where Mariko is as his translator. So he's seen as having dishonored his host. And there's a scene with Toranaga. I think this is in episode 6, this scene, where we find out a bit more about their relationship. And this all ties into Mariko's backstory, right? Which we probably ought to cover in order to be able to talk about Buntaro properly. So Mariko's father killed the ruler of Japan before the Taiko, who was corrupt, we're led to believe. And because of that, because he dishonored himself by doing that, he had to kill himself and his family. But because Mariko was already married by that point and didn't share his name, she was not part of that culling. So Mariko, on the anniversary of that happening, has asked Buntaro if she can die, and he's refused her that, which I think he sees as a kindness to her because has feelings for her, I guess. But it's meant that she's always been quite cold towards Buntaro.
I guess there's an element of it being a kindness. But also, I mean, so he is significantly older. If we didn't already work that out, we were told explicitly that there was an age gap between them. But I wonder, because he does exude all the traits of a very fragile masculinity, where he feels that his station is higher and he is a quote-unquote good man, or maybe as Shakespeare would put it, a proper man. But his wife is smarter, savvier, and just generally has more standing in the court, has the ear of their feudal lord, and also comes from a family of good stock, although they have been dishonored. I wonder if there's also that's one thing he has control over. I can make you live. I will make you still live under my dominion. That's the only power I have over you.
I mean, get you bringing the bard out this early on in the pod. I guess what she says to Ochibra, I think, that the marriage is a lesser one. That marrying Buntaro initially isn't a great catch. And she's always been kind of confused as to why her father did that to her. Torunaga later says, well, it's because he knew what he was going to do and he wanted you to be safe so you could come back and finish the job. So I think initially maybe there was a bit of snootiness from Mariko. Then her family's dishonoured and obviously he has then sort of got the higher ground, if you like. But yeah, it's a bit of a weird dynamic. And I think he's quite jealous of the way that Mariko is towards Blackthorn. She's always been cold to him, but she's different with the Anjin.
Yeah, I mean, if I watched more trash TV, I'm sure I could make a joke about Love Island or something like that. That Mariko is Blackthorn's on paper. I don't even know the terminology. I tried. But I think in the end, Mariko's just pied off her husband for Blackthorn. Is that what they say?
Maybe. I have no idea. I'm equally clueless.
we need Grace and Izzy, our resident experts on such televisual programming. Yeah, I mean, it is awkward as fuck, right? Because I think that there was a real chance that things might have progressed between Mariko and Blackthorn, and then he just turns up, and they're like, oh, gosh. That is awkward. And then I suppose maybe there's already had been a cooling off at that point. But I mean, they're going to get back together, obviously. But it's interesting that the dynamic of their relationship through these two episodes. I think we get even more of a journey than we have done previously.
Of Mariko and Blackthorn, yes. I mean, they have that kind of big falling out, which is essentially around... I mean, Buntaro makes Mariko... sort of forces Mariko to tell Blackthorn her backstory. And then there's a couple of lines, actually, that I really liked that he says to her, I think. You'd die to avenge your father. You'd live in anguish to spite your husband. What becomes of you? And that approach is enough for Mariko to say, look, we ain't friends no more. I'm going to translate for you, but otherwise we are not going to speak to each other.
Yeah. Now, so what I think is interesting later, that when she's forced to start telling the story, Blackthorn says, look, just make it up. He doesn't know that you're telling me this. Just make it up. So he's trying to save her blushes. He's still trying to maintain that relationship. But yeah, she has absolutely shown him the iciness that she's shown her husband.
I think it's one of the brilliant parts of the show is looking at the moments where Mariko directly translates what's being said to her and the moments where she chooses to say something slightly different but still convey the message. And the choices that she makes in each of those moments, I think, is telling. That's a brilliant device.
Yeah, it really helps us see how she feels about Blackthorn in that moment as to how truthful she is. Yeah, I think that whole translation section is so expertly done. I think it's probably one of my favourite bits of the show. And it also just shows, by her being the translator, how much power she really has.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll park them for now, and we'll come back to them when we get to Ladies of the Willow World, because there's definitely more movement in their relationship in that episode. But I want to talk a little bit about the Regents, and I think this is the moment that you were talking about. This is for the second screeners who need that reminder of what's going on. But they basically sort of discuss the political situation and the plot so far. But episode five is bookended by Lady Achiba, who is the mother of the heir. She's been released from Edo, which is where she was. We're pretty sure now that she was being held hostage by Torunaga at Edo. But she has been released, and she's kind of on their way back. But they are useless bureaucrats, essentially, aren't they? Because they can't impeach Torunaga without a fifth member on the Council of Regents. And they're trying to decide who it is. And one option's too stupid and rural. Another option's too Christian. Another option's too syphilitic. I just really enjoyed them all putting these different people forward. And when they eventually do, in episode six, find a fifth member of the council, they still can't get the vote through. And then end up assassinating one of them. So they're back to square one, where they've only got four regents. But there was this moment where they're discussing the fifth member, as it were, and each of them are coughing and being taken away. And I was a bit confused as to what was going on there. Did you notice that or have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, so I think it's... Well, so we already know... there's one of them that's hidden behind the screen who has quite pronounced full-on leprosy, right? And then I think the other one has... Oh, is it all some kind of syphilitic stuff? I think... The first person that they bring is riddled with syphilis, and then the second person they bring is just, yeah, has got some kind of coughing fit. I think it's just generally that they're all old men who are in very poor health physically and probably mentally as well, which just shows how much Ishido is just completely isolated, because amongst all this, he's still trying to be an honest broker in this. But he has definitely had his head turned by the Empress.
And Ishido is, we learn, I think we probably knew this before, but he's from a kind of working class background, right? From a rural background, and has, you know, made his way in the world rather than inheriting it, which I think is also true of the previous ruler of the Taiko. And I think there's some significance in all of that stuff. The history of each of the characters, I think, is pretty key as we go through the show. Well, let's move on to Torunaga a bit. Because he's returned, we get his favourite metaphor, the falcon, back again. he says, all men are like falcons. Some are flown straight from the fist, killing anything that moves. Others are lazy and tempted by the lure, but all men can be broken. Learn to fly them at the right game, and they will do the hunting for you. This is when he's speaking to his son, Nagakado, who he's kind of criticising for doing what he did with the cannons. But later on, when he's talking to Yabushige, he's praising Omi for manipulating Nagakado into doing this, right?
Yeah, but you know, we say this many times that Lord Yoshi is an incredibly astute and intelligent man. He is definitely a player of realpolitik. And I think it's that thing of he realizes his son has been manipulated, and that isn't good, because it wasn't his son's idea. It is a great idea. Omni is clearly a very smart man, or at least he is, like his uncle, so hungry for position, but smarter than his uncle, and therefore able to make better decisions. Of course, we know that he didn't. It was actually our favourite concubine. No, what courtesan, sorry, pouring honey in his ear. Another Othello reference there. That is really interesting. I think there's so much really good stuff that goes on with Lord Yoshi. I think it's episode five as well, where he realizes that something is up between Mariko, and Blackthorn. And he's just totally on top of it. He just understands how to read people and use that to his advantage. And then, of course, after that conversation, I believe that's when, you know, we talked about it in another episode, that Mariko had mentioned that that Japan is a hard and difficult place to live. And we had a tectonic moment. Suddenly all these birds fly into the air, and next thing you know, half of a mountain's, well, I suppose not a mountain, but there's definitely a massive mudslide.
Yeah, it was pretty dramatic stuff, and we didn't have to wait too long for that earthquake line to pay off. And it's Blackthorn who obviously dives down and rescues Toranaga, which means that he gets promoted to General of the Cannon or whatever it is. So Iommi got promoted in episode 5 to be in charge of the Cannon Regiment. And by episode 6, he'd already been demoted because Blackthorn was suddenly the General of the Cannons, whatever name it was. Apparently, I read that they built this whole sort of cliff face, and Cosmo Jarvis said it was the most fun he ever had filming anything because he just got to dive down this kind of manufactured foam cliff again and again and again.
It looked good fun. And of course, the other thing is, not only does he dig Lord Yoshi out, we also find out that Yoshi has, I think, one of his sigils has broken and got lost. But more importantly, his swords have been swallowed up by the mud as well. So he's unarmed. Immediately, Blackthorn gives him the swords that he'd been given to by his pillow wife of
Consort.
consort. Thank you, consort, the pillow consort. And we also learned that those were fake swords given to her because her father had also done something dishonorable. So I think, yeah, I wonder how, what's the word I'm looking for? It's the Easter weekend, so my brain is half working. But you know, he's lost his swords, the family swords, the Yoshi swords. They are gone. And he is in turn given swords that have a history of deceit to them. And given that this is originally quite a lengthy novel, you feel that that probably says something.
Yeah, but Blackthorn's giving them, and he believes that they are special swords that are being. But he's unaware of the sort of dishonor behind those weapons. So I think there's a little smile from Yoshi, isn't there, at that moment that he gets them. But yeah, it feels like there's an irony or a meaning or something to that. Of course, the gifts aren't just one way. Yoshi has given Blackthorn a pheasant, which he gets very excited about. So excited that he tells Fuji and the staff to leave it hanging, even if it stinks. It needs to be cured, and we're going to hang it here for a while. Touch it and die. In his broken Japanese.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about this bit of the story, to be honest. I mean, I guess, yeah, it's because he wants it to be cured, and Mariko isn't there to explain it. But I thought that's what was in the stew that they wouldn't eat. This rabbit stew that he had to improvise with.
Well, the pheasant eventually gets taken down by the gardener, Wejiro, I think his name is. I probably butchered the pronunciation of that, which is, I think, another fascinating part of the story. But it gives us a lot of comedy because Fuji's telling the rest of the staff, literally, don't touch anything that he uses because he's unclean. He has all these weird methods of preparing and cooking food. And eventually, she throws the rabbit stew into the sea, I think. This gets a bit complicated. So we learn that the fisherman, whose name begins with M, and I can't remember off. Yeah.
Miraji.
We learn that he's really a prized samurai, Tonomoto Akinoa, and he is the spy in Ajiro that Yabushige has been trying to find. And Toranaga tells him to find a patsy, basically, to find somebody else to take the heat off him as the spy. And then we learn that Wejiro, the gardener, took down the pheasant and was killed because of it. Because Blackthorn had said, move it and die. But basically, the village had said, horrendous smell. Somebody's got to do something about it. There was a council meeting. And I think pretty much what we're led to believe is that Miraji persuaded Wejiro to say, I'll do it. I'm old and sick. I'll take it down. And then whatever befalls me, befalls me. Because then later on, Miraji presents to Yabushige documents and stuff that points to him being the spy.
I'm not sure if that is quite what happens. I think it just happens. And then because he's a very resourceful bloke, Miraji says, oh, it's this guy.
No, there's a moment where Miraji and Wejiro are talking about the pheasant. I'm sure of it.
Oh,
And I was like,
okay.
God,
That's a good spot.
it was him all along. He's the one that's basically caused this death. And Blackthorn is devastated because he's had a really lovely chat with this gardener whilst they've been putting this rock in place and stuff. And Fuji's saying, kill me too, kill me too. This is all happening just before the earthquake. But yeah, it really shakes Blackthorne, I think. He learns that his words have meaning in this culture and have weight. And then he has to be careful about what he says. He can't just butcher the language and say these things because people will take it very, very seriously.
Yeah. What does he say? You value life so cheaply in the Japans or you know, or something to that effect. But yeah, it's intense, right? Pretty intense stuff.
There's a lovely moment after the earthquake where he goes back to find Fuji and check that she's still alive. And once he's seen that she's okay, he then goes into the garden and moves the rock that the gardener had been talking about before, which I thought was just, yeah, a really lovely touch.
Well, the episode, I think it opens with the gardener saying, it's not a garden unless there's a stone in it. Is it something like that?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I hadn't written that one down, but yeah. But yeah, I think we've covered pretty much everything that happens in episode 5. There's one line I wanted to pull out when Buntaro and Blackthorne are having their drinking contest. And he's like, tell me a story. And Buntaro says, heroism is for the dead and stories are for children. He's the life and soul of the party, isn't he?
Yeah, but if you cheat, cheat death. If you steal the heart of a woman. If you lie in the everlasting warmth of her bosom. And if you drink with me.
Classic. I mean, I do love that. But he has, obviously, cheated with Buntaro's wife.
Yeah.
Although he thought he was dead at the time, so, you know, it probably doesn't really count.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, probably won't have to go to some kind of court.
Well, that episode ends with Achiba. I said it. She bookended the episode, but she basically has come to the council and said that the council will answer to her now. So she's in charge. She's told Ishido that she's the one who's going to be calling all of the shots from now on. And it feels like we've got a new enemy for Torunaga at this point.
And she's far savvier. And I've said savvy about 50 times already this episode, so apologies, listeners. But she is definitely more political and more ruthless than those around her.
Perhaps a more worthy opponent for Torunaga.
Maybe.
Well, we definitely learn there's animosity there in episode 6. We get a lot of background, a lot of flashbacks. The episode opens 22 years earlier, and we see young Mariko and young Achiba. And Mariko's father is being sort of held back by Torunaga, this previous ruler whose name I've completely forgotten.
Dave.
But yeah.
Dave-san.
And the whole sort of, we learn later on in the episode that the reason Achiba is anti-Yoshi is that she believes that he had something to do. He was the idea. He was the pulling the strings, basically. And he was the one who had it was her father, wasn't it? Achiba's father was the previous ruler. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah, is that right?
And then she's
something like that.
Then she marries. No, she doesn't marry the Taiko. Taiko's married to somebody else. She ends up being a concubine, doesn't she, for the Taiko.
But the important bit of information we learn in this episode is that he slept with hundreds of women and he could not get any of them pregnant. But by chance, she became pregnant. And we see this really quite grim sex scene between the two of them, the complete opposite of what we see between Mariko and Blackthorne a couple of episodes ago. And it does make me wonder as to whether the child is actually the child of the emperor or someone else.
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely something that's called into question. I think it's pretty clear that the heir isn't actually the child of the Taiko at all. I mean, she says she compelled fate to look at her so she could scratch out its eyes. But Damo, we're about to be joined by Mr. Neil Shepek.
Oh, bring him in.
Are you there, Neil? So listeners, Neil's been at a wedding today, but here he is.
Hello, Adam and Damo. Yeah, I have been at a wedding. Just got home now. And like any wedding, you know, it's just a day of starting to drink at 1 in the afternoon and then it just keeps going. And it was an amazing occasion. Gav is someone who has certainly been one of my best friends for many years and I know is loved hugely by both of you two as well. And honestly, I am so, so happy for Gav, I've seen him since, I've known him since he moved to London, and now he's met the most amazing, beautiful person in Clare. It was absolutely a stunning event. I'm so glad I was there.
Well, huge congratulations to Gav and Clare. You joined us, Neil, as we were talking about episode 6, so just to catch you up on where we're at. And we were just talking about the flashbacks with Mariko and Achiba and learning more about them as characters. We get a lovely scene with Torunaga talking to his followers. Again, a brilliant line. Death is the end of having lived, he tells them, as he's about to send them all to their deaths.
It is an affirmation of life itself.
There we go. But yeah, meanwhile, Yabushige doesn't think that it's going to go particularly well because it says it's time to write another will.
I love this running joke. It's like, how good is this, Will? Is this better than the best one that I had?
But the key thing in this episode, obviously it's called Ladies of the Willow World, but the Torunaga has been made, he's kind of become aware of this thing between Buntaro and Mariko and Blackthorn. And he thinks that what needs to happen is that Blackthorn needs to go for a night at the brothel. Spend the night with the finest courtesan. But Mariko gets sent along as translator.
And spy.
Spy, yeah. It's really interesting, the whole spying stuff, because she feels like she's being spied on. The madam of the brothel makes a real thing of saying there'll be no prying eyes here. But Mariko's like, don't embarrass me, don't make a scene. Everyone is watching, or people are watching. We're always being watched. Yeah, what did you think of the Willows world?
Well, I mean, just talking about the brothel, there was the option for Mariko and Blackthorn to have some time together, which Mariko said no to. Blackthorn just kind of slightly touched her hand as he went off. I mean, who's going to turn down a courtesan of that quality? But yeah, there's a kind of, I guess, a sexual, well, we know it's sexual tension. They've become as one, as I believe some Japanese person must have said at some point. But yeah, there's definitely tension there.
As we said earlier, that courtesan happens to be the one who spoke to, oh, I've forgotten the guy's name now, but gave the idea to set the cannon on Chosen and his gang, the Chosen Ones, as we called them. So she is, I mean, I don't know what you chaps feel. I think I said this previously. I reckon that she is probably in the pay of someone back in Osaka.
Yeah, I had assumed she was the rat that they were searching for, but I think you're right, because the rat actually that they're in Ajiro is reporting to Torunaga, and we now know that's the fisherman. So yeah, I think you're probably right. But she says they enrich the mind and nurture the spirit at the Willow World, much like we do on TV DNA. And she gives this whole kind of speech, which Mariko then has to translate. It's kind of this really lovely moment of Mariko and Blackthorn kind of connecting through that. And then when he has to go off to the private room with her on his way out, as you said, he touches her hand and it feels like they're previous animosity that built up in the last episode has dissipated a little bit.
I think during this conversation, Blackthorn has a line I absolutely loved, which was, where I come from, prostitutes are neither this well presented nor as inquisitive.
Yeah,
it was a nice comparison with London prostitutes, wasn't it? Any other thoughts then on the brothel stuff? I mean, do you think he goes through with the act? I think he does, doesn't he? Otherwise, he's...
Probably. I mean, he's a sailor. I mean, when in Rome or when in Japan, you've got to sample the culture.
Yeah. He definitely pillowed, right? But I think I think he has to anyway, because then it will get back to whoever that he didn't. So he seems quite reticent to do so, and he seems far more worried about how Mariko feels about it. But yeah, he looks like he's done it when they come down, and she, the way the concubine, the courtesan, sorry, looks at him, there's something there that I think is quite interesting when she says, you know, that conversation where she says he can come back anytime, and he's like, well, compliment her on her service or words to that effect. And there is a moment And then we see the two sons, the two Nepo babies, sorry, the nephew and the son in the gateway watching. And then we just have this eye contact between the courtesan and Omni. I just think that could also be another reason why Omni might come for Blackthorn. Not only has he taken his position, he's now had sex with his woman.
It's a lot clearer in the director's X-rated cut.
Kiku is the name of the courtesan, and she says at one point to Mariko, "A woman cannot look away when another suffers." And then later we get Mariko talking to Toranaga, and he's trying to find out why Ochiba doesn't like him. And Mariko says, "A man may go to war for many reasons: conquest, pride, power, but a woman is simply at war."
Yeah.
So good.
My other favorite line in the whole brothel thing was, "I ask you into my openness."
It's more of that cloud talk, isn't it? It's more of that cloud and rain talk.
Yeah.
Well, just putting it out there, I'm always open. My openness is open to a lot of people. Stop myself from saying if you want.
We'll drop your phone number and address in the podcast description notes. For those who want to take you up on it. What else do we get in this episode? We've kind of covered a little bit of it when we were talking about episode five.
There's one scene that I really enjoyed where it's post brothel and everything that's gone on. Mariko's obviously in a bad way, and she kneels down in her room and she starts saying the Lord's Prayer in Latin because obviously she's Catholic. And Blackthorn hears a noise like we've seen previously. Hears her making some noise. Obviously, previously it's because she's getting beaten up by her husband, but this time he stops, he listens, and he realizes that she's saying the Lord's Prayer in Latin. And he kneels down, facing her the other side of this partition, and starts saying the Lord's Prayer in English because he's Protestant, and so therefore he would say the Lord's Prayer in English rather than Latin, as Catholics did at the time. And I really like this, the symbolism of that, because it literally was this really thin line that separated them. Much like the Reformation, I would say. But yeah, I thought that was a really lovely moment to see that there was still a connection there between them.
It's no surprise that he heard her praying because those walls are paper thin, right? There's another element I wanted to pick up on in this episode, which is the kind of religious war we haven't really talked about much, hasn't featured that much so far in this. But Blackthorn wants his ship back so that he can attack the black ship, the Portuguese ship. And Toranaga's like, "That's not my fight. That's not my battle. Why would we attack a friendly nation?" And then we also have a scene with the priests. We meet young Martin, the young priest again, and they've been refused entry. The Ishido and Achiba have taken all of the regents and their families hostage, and nobody is allowed in, not even the priests. And Martin is kind of suggesting that they've picked the wrong ally and maybe they should be allied with Toranaga, which will obviously put them into, if Toranaga accepts their allegiance, that's going to put him into conflict then with the Anjin.
Well, yeah, well, previously in that kind of boat race that they had in episode three, was it? Yoshi wasn't, he made some pretty solid deals. He was going to allow a church in, all these things. He knows that if he can get the church on side, the Catholic Church, that is, he can possibly turn two of the five, or at that time, of the other four regents to his side and would therefore have a majority. So it's more politicking. He can't go to war against the establishment of Japan and the Catholic Church. He's picked the slightly smaller, easier enemy to fight.
The other thing we have is the no theater sequence. Okay, whilst these regents are all locked up in their sort of captivity, they get treated to a bit of theater, which is nice. And it is the story of Achiba's father who is killed. I think that's the way that that story is. I think that's the story that they're telling during that play.
Yeah, he was the previous shogun.
Yeah, it's so funny because at the beginning of this, I was watching it and I was like, well, there's lots of focus culturally in Japan on ritual and things being a very specific way. And I was thinking, so this is a very interesting style of theatre. It's not to my taste, but I can understand why here's what it is. And then, you know, within 5 minutes of it being over, it's clear that the audience thought it was shit as well, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and Lord Ito is the actor who's being praised and buttered up afterwards, and then he's the one that they want to become the fifth regent, very much Ishido's man. But then, of course, they go and kill one of the other regents, Sugiyama, because he doesn't vote with them, and then tries to flee. He gets killed at the end, so they're back down to having four regents again, and still unable to impeach Torunaga.
Is that the same place that we had in one of the earlier episodes? People were trying to leave and they got ambushed and absolutely sliced to pieces. Is this just a very treacherous path to take in the woods out of Osaka?
Yeah, you would think that they would take another path, maybe. Maybe it's just the shortest route. Yeah, not particularly strategic. Speaking of strategy, there's a
Ooh.
strategy meeting that Torunaga has with all of his people where they're talking about what they need to do. And his number two, can't remember, Hiramatsu, I think maybe is his name. He's fled Osaka. He was in Osaka, but previously he's had to leave all the wives behind just to get out. He turns up pretty exhausted on a horse. But anyway, he basically says the time has come for Crimson Sky, which is a single violent rush on Osaka Castle. So it's going to be a big army storming Osaka, probably losing a lot of lives. But that's the kind of plan that they previously cooked up. Omi suggests that they wait, and Nagakado urges Torunaga to become a shogun, and he basically spits back at them, "Find me a plan that works." And then once they learn of Sugoyama's death, he's like, right, Crimson Sky time.
Yeah, and Torunaga kind of sees it as his, I don't know, destiny or fate or family. Whether that's an excuse he's giving himself, or whether, you know, I mean, God, even in our own country, you know, the divine right of kings and all of that, you know, there are many religions that choose leaders based on family rights and stuff like that. But that seems to say to him, or give him a message that the time is now.
Yeah, I think it was also interesting in that kind of chat that, well, the discussion, the team meeting, if you will, they have first when Omni gives his suggestion, and Torunaga is, I mean, you can see the respect he has for Omni because he doesn't shut him down. He wants to know why. He's curious because he sees another one who is good at strategy. We also get a lovely bit from Yabashige as well. We haven't seen much of him these two episodes, but him kind of being like, oh, what's Crimson Sky? Which I thought was quite fun. And also something we didn't cover was, you know, we talked before about how smart Torunaga is. He has a conversation with Yabashige earlier where he's like, right, well, actually, I want you to go to Osaka and strike a deal. So basically, I have someone in court. And Yabashige's kind of like, what do you mean? I'm loyal. I said I was loyal. And he was like, yeah, whatever, mate. Just if do that. And then obviously events transpire that means that Yabushige stays. But I just think that's also very interesting. We didn't get very much of Yabushige, and I would like to get more, please.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's such a great character. The one thing that Yoshi says at the end of the episode, when he's talking about Crimson Sky, he says it's for the defense of the air. And I think he must know. He's a smart cookie. I think he must know that Taiko's air isn't really his genetic air.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether he's talking about his own air in that, and whether his plan is to. You know, we've seen him educating Nagakado throughout the series, whether his plan is to rule so that he can then pass it on to his son.
Yeah, but I think also air as in the cannons are going to break down the walls of Osaka. You know, this is their ace up their sleeve in this war. Is the cannons and the artillery and knowing how to use them and how devastating they are compared to anything else that is available in terms of armament in Japan. So I think it's yet again a very smart play on words.
Speaking of play on words, I did wonder whether I'd misheard him and that potentially there were some restorative products in Osaka because some of them are quite balding and maybe it was just for defense of the hair.
Dear Adam, I didn't know how much you discussed about things that Ishiba told to Ishido if I pronounce either of those right, about that, quite clearly the apparent heir is not. He was made to think it was, but he clearly couldn't conceive. Well, he couldn't contribute to the conception of a child.
I think it definitely shows how clever and manipulative Achiba is. Really sets her up as a great opponent to Torunaga.
Yeah, we also get that flashback, don't we, when the original wife is passing the mirror to her and saying, "Look, I was going to keep this for if I had a child, but I didn't, so I will give this willingly to whoever can produce a child for my husband." So she and the way she was taken, or at least we get that lovely shot of her reflection in that mirror, thinking about it. It's yeah, she's a schemer, that one.
But also, what's her alternative?
Totally.
I absolutely don't judge her necessarily as a schemer or as a schemer. She's fighting for survival, like so many, particularly women, but so many people are in that scenario.
You could just Netflix and chill.
Didn't work for him.
Adam, when you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die.
Fair enough.
I read something, I can't remember what it was, but someone referring to like Torunaga is the Ned Stark of this series, kind of holds everything together. And with what, four episodes left or three episodes left, the him suddenly dying would be such a George R. R. Martin move.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly a big player, isn't he? And I think that the story is about the three of them. It's about Torunaga, and it's about Blackthorn, and it's about Mariko. Whether all three are going to survive to the end, I don't know.
Have you not read the book, Adam?
No.
I'm calling this right now. Torunaga gets into the throne room, mortally wounded. He dies. Blackthorn's holding him in his arms, and he says, "Go home. I give you your freedom to go home."
You've read the
Yeah.
book.
I haven't read the book, but it feels like the most obvious interest, well, not interesting, but the clearest narrative choice.
Well, whatever happens, it's show gonna be exciting.
Oh, is this the sign off now for this series, Adam?
It might be, yeah. Are there any other points you want to pick up on? Any lines that you particularly liked that you want to close us out with? Whilst you're thinking about that, I'll just let you know that you can, if you want to, contact us via the social media at tvdnapod, or you can email tvdnapod@gmail.com. We are going to be back with another very exciting watch list episode coming out fairly soon. We'll be talking about the BAFTAs, we're talking about Renegade Nell and all sorts of other stuff. And we'll also be announcing what our next featured show is going to be. But yeah, any final thoughts or lines from you guys?
Well, your secret heart is not secret to me.
Reclaim our family's legacy and become shogun.
And I'm going to give you the line that Torunaga gives to Mariko. He married you off so you could survive the fight and one day return to finish it.
Is she going to finish them off?
Well, she's definitely finished Blackthorn off, right?
Yeah, that's
Yeah, but all of them.
a lot of work. It
Yeah,
is a
she
lot of work. Also, sorry, just quickly, I know we've signed off, but I wanted to just quickly add about the army. Just before the mudslide, we see in the background this giant army, and we only see maybe one or two scenes with it. I'm very excited of the size of Yoshi's host.
Quite a few of them go down in the earthquake, though, don't they?
Well, this is what I was trying to
That's not
work
what I
out.
would do in an earthquake. I'd be running for my life.
That's why Yabushige's so keen to write his will, is because a lot of the soldiers die in the earthquake, and his army isn't quite as impressive. His host is not as big as it used to be. But
Amen to
old
that.
age happens to us all.
We'll end with that, shall we?